to cross a single ion. So it's about 10 to the minus 23 seconds, and the size is that of a gold ion, for instance, 10 femtometers, roughly speaking. So that's sort of the characteristics. And what I'll be arguing is that it turns out that fluid dynamics, the theory of relativistic fluid dynamics, provides a good description of the experimental data that's coming out from these collisions. I want to spend two slides on just motivating my take on how the theory of fluid dynamics should be thought of. Basically, what I'd like to promote is this notion that fluid dynamics is nothing else but an effective theory of matter at very long timescales and very small gradients. So the way that you would go about in constructing any effective field theory is that you sort of first define what are your degrees of freedom. In this case, for fluids, that's not hard to do. Fluids have fluid velocities. In our case, that would be the fluid flow velocity u mu. Fluids also have pressure or densities. In our case, because we are thinking, at least in this case, at relativistic systems where basically the charge is almost zero, the energy density becomes a good quantity to think of. And at least in general, we may be thinking about fluids that live on curved spacetimes. So the metric tensor G mu also becomes a degree of freedom that should be in the description. And it turns out that once you've identified those degrees of freedom, the energy density, the fluid velocity, and the energy momentum tensor, you can write down objects of interest for your effective field theory and sort of see where it leads you. If you've looked at textbooks on quantum field theory, on fluid dynamics like Landau-Lifshitz, then you'll realize that fluid dynamics basically is concerned with the conservation of energy and momentum. So the energy momentum tensor, T mu nu, would be a good object to study. And basically what you do is you sort of write down the most general expression of T mu nu that's built out of these building blocks. And let's forget about gradients right now, just algebraic combinations of a scalar, a four vector, and a tensor, with the only sort of additional ingredient that you have to specify what symmetry group that object should fulfill. First of all, think about relativistic systems. Poincaré group is a good symmetry group. If you thought about crystals, for instance, with a preferred direction, that symmetry group would be different, and also the expression would be different. But right now, there's nothing complicated. We're thinking about space without any sort of preferred directions. And we write down the most general expression for this T mu nu. That's a sort of trivial exercise. Sort of takes you half a page or so to work out what the expression should be. And if you then look at the conservation of energy momentum, d mu, t mu nu is zero, you stare at equations, maybe you take the non-relativistic limit if you're so inclined, you find that those are nothing else but the equations of Euler and the continuity equation. So those are just the ideal fluid dynamic equations as were written down basically 250 years ago in the non-relativistic limit. So that's all it takes for you to rediscover fluid dynamics. In this case, that would be fluid dynamics where we explicitly forbid any gradients of the degrees of freedom. And there's no coupling to dissipative terms at this point. However, you can improve on the description, systematically improve on the description, by including gradient terms. And you can sort of set up a counting scheme that includes first-order gradients, second-order gradients, and so on. So if you include only first-order gradients, then you write down the energy momentum tensor that includes all the expressions up to first-order gradients. You again look at the conservation equations, and out pop the equations of Navier-Stokes with unknown coefficients. So in principle, the viscosity coefficients there would just be numbers. You don't know what they are. But the structure of the equations is that of Navier and Stokes. So that's how you would sort of derive basically all of atmospheric science without ever recurring to it. And I always want to stress this. This derivation of fluid dynamics doesn't make any notion of particles. It doesn't make any notion of what system it is that you're actually describing. So that means that the theory you've set up, this effective field theory, is universal. It describes all matter as long as gradients are small and the symmetry group is right. And in that sense, it's sort of maybe the ultimate universal theory that we have is fluid dynamics. It describes just everything. And that's not surprising given that we know that, for instance, gases can behave like fluids. All of weather forecasting is done that way, basically. Okay, so to get back to the problem at hand, it turns out that for relativistic systems, the relativistic Navier-Stokes equations are actually not that good. And the reason basically is that if you look at the equations, they essentially contain a part that has the form of a diffusion equation, first order in time, second order in space. If you look at the dispersion relation for that equation, you find that obviously that has a speed of propagation or speed of information transfer that's proportional to the wave number k. That means that arbitrarily high wave number volts essentially travel as fast as they want. So there's no, it certainly does not violate, it certainly does not obey the speed of light as a sort of limiting velocity. So this explicitly breaks causality. And that's nothing that's particularly new. In a different context, this was already known to Maxwell, a fame of the Maxwell equations, because he sort of was also concerned with the diffusion equation, in this case heat diffusion. And he and contemporary sort of scholars found a simple solution to this, which was that, okay, if I were to modify the equations by including yet higher order ingredients and do a particular resummation scheme, then I could come up with a diffusion equation in this case that contains second order time derivatives in addition to the first order time derivatives and second order space derivatives that could repair causality. And that's basically known as the Maxwell-Cataneo type equations. Long story short, in essence, that's basically what we follow in the modern context. We sort of use this effective field theory description to write down the most general expression of T mu up to second order ingredients. And then we do a particular resummation scheme that sort of is sometimes called Isier-Stewart theory, sometimes called causal relativistic fluid dynamics, second order fluid dynamics, and so on. Those are all the same. There's all different names for the same story. We end up with evolution equations that manifestly fulfill causality. And the nice thing about those is that you can actually put them on a computer and solve numerically, whereas, for instance, relativistic Navier-Stokes equation violating causality, if you tried that, the initial conditions are not well posed. There will be numerical instabilities that you find if you just blindly closed your eyes and were to sort of try to simulate that. So the main message I want to bring across is that owing to the work of many people in the past 10 or 20 years, that's basically a solved problem. We know how to do this. And basically, we can actually sort of solve relativistic fluid dynamics in the presence of viscosity and relativistic fluid velocities. And that's an example of what you can do with this. This is a particular subset of experimental data. These are flow coefficients Vn as a function of centrality of heavy ion collisions. So that just means that if you have heavy ion collisions, there are two of these heavy ions that sort of come in. If they actually hit each other head on, you have zero impact parameter, and that's called a central collision. It would be here, basically at zero. Whereas if the two nuclei completely miss each other, you basically don't get anything, and you would be in the 100% centrality class. And anything else is some combination in between, basically. So this is what this centrality axis here is. The Vn coefficients here, sometimes I like to compare to essentially L modes in the CMB spectrum. As maybe sort of a simple analogy, think of these as the L2, L3, L4, and L5 mode in CMB spectrum. So those are experimentally measured in heavy ion collisions. And the experimental data is given by these different symbols here. And the lines with the bands here are simulations, solutions of relativistic fluid dynamics in the presence of viscosity. And you can see that you get a very sort of good description of the experimental data. And that's just a subset of all the things you can do. If you look at it more closely, it turns out that you can actually well describe 99% of the particles that are experimentally measured at these heavy ion colliders using fluid dynamics. So the upshot of the story is that even though I sort of started out saying that you have this very small, very short-lived system that's very hot, the experimental evidence seems to be pointing towards the fact that fluid dynamics does a very good job in describing that experimental data. Some people may be surprised about this, or very surprised about that, because you would have thought, at least before turning on the colliders, that in QCD, owing to asymptotic freedom, the interaction should go down, and you would sort of expect more like an ideal gas picture than an ideal fluid picture. And let me remind you, those are two opposites, complete opposites, basically, because an ideal gas is sort of the worst fluid ever. It has an infinite viscosity, because basically it just doesn't care about what all the other particles are doing, whereas an ideal fluid cares a lot about what everything else is doing. It's sort of the ultimate collective phenomenon, and it has very small viscosity, essentially. Okay, so the questions that sort of this observation begs is that even though the gradients are large, hydrodynamics sort of applies. The question is why? Why does hydrodynamics do such a good job in describing the data? Or sort of similar to that question is, can we understand how the system at all gets close to hydrodynamics in the first place? By the way, if there's some questions anywhere, then I'll be happy to sort of answer. If you sort of think about this for a moment, then you could come up with the question, well, why should I care? I mean, it seems to work, so why should I be even sort of wasting time in studying what happens before hydrodynamic actually turns on? And the reason that I'll give you is that hydrodynamic actually requires initial conditions, as all these sort of initial value problems do. And for the most part, these are basically chosen ad hoc. You have to choose a velocity profile, you have to choose a profile for your stress tensor. All of those are things that people don't compute. They are just given by hand, and for most part, people just set them to zero because it's sort of the easiest guess in some sense. So there's a very incomplete survey of what different groups were doing with the hydrodynamic simulations last year, basically. They chose different starting times for hydrodynamics. They chose different flow velocities, some of them zero, some of them non-zero. None of these models basically used an initial condition that was equilibrated in the sense that if you changed your hydrodynamic starting time, then the answer that you would get would depend on what you chose. And they just chose their parameters such that the data was well represented. That basically was the name of the game. And then, is there a question?
So in the blog, you showed the comparison before. So what are you using this?
So that's actually Schenk et al. 2013. Oh. And that's one of the groups here. So they chose a hydrodynamic starting time of 0.2 Fermi. They choose a particular form of the flow velocity that's coming out of this IP Glasma model. And it was not equilibrated. So their answer would change whether they sort of chose that particular combination or any other. Pretty much all of them now use lattice QCD equations of state. There are subtle differences, but it turns out that for the actual comparison to data, it doesn't really matter at that level anymore. So there's 10% differences in the equation of state you won't see on these uncertainty bars here. They're pretty much insensitive to what you actually do with the precise equation of state, as long as it has a phase transition at about the right temperature. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
When you come there with the initial flow velocity chosen and the initial energy distribution?
Energy distribution, this model was also from the Glasma type model. That basically is a version where you take the saturation scale to be given by the global distribution, and then they use sort of the substructure. So they sort of have a very spiky, very non-trivial initial conditions that they sort of simulate. The others did something else. So the others typically use Glauber, just optical Glauber or Monte Carlo Glauber, basically. I can discuss in more detail about what that means. But okay, so basically, what I want to argue is that these choices here matter in the sense that different initial conditions lead to subtly different results, or sometimes not subtly, but actually pretty different results. Typically, nowadays, these are just retuned such that you match the data well, in particular that you match the particle spectra well. Unfortunately, by doing so, you hide some of the physics. So in particular, you sort of lose some sensitivity to properties that you were actually interested in, such as transfer properties, maybe also some properties of the initial conditions. So I want to argue that basically by guessing the initial conditions rather than having an actual, at least a model of what they should be, we're actually limiting ourselves about our ability to learn about basic QCD properties. So rather than guessing the initial conditions for hydrodynamics, I would like to have, if possible, a theory, if that's not available, at least a model of what the initial conditions for hydrodynamics should be. And I want to argue that ADS-CFT may provide just such a model. I don't have to spend much time about motivating ADS-CFT correspondence in this audience, but basically I just want to say that if we can't solve QCD in real time, there's, for instance, the sign problem that doesn't let us evolve lattice QCD at real time. It's a strong coupling problem, so we can't use perturbation theory. It's a many-body problem, so we can't use single particle techniques. So really, we are pretty stuck there. So the idea is that, okay, maybe QCD is too hard. Maybe we can say something about the sister theory or a cousin theory or however you want to call it. In this case, n equals 4 supermills in the limit of large numbers and large coupling constant. We have lost some properties along the way. If we sort of did this switch to n equals 4 supermills, we have lost asymptotic freedom. We have lost confinement, and we have many more and different degrees of freedom than QCD. The story is not as bad as it made sort of look at this point, because some of these properties may actually not be that relevant. For instance, confinement is obviously very relevant if you want to study a nucleus sitting there. But if you're interested about properties of matter beyond the deconfinement scale, then the deconfined really is just a notion that's not that important. And none of the other models in QCD have them either. So for instance, the color glass model is not confining either. They don't have that. Anyways, okay, so what we want to do is QCD, three color, G on the order of one. What we think we can do is n equals to a supermills, infinite number of colors, infinite coupling via holography. So in a sense, what we sort of propose to do is we want to approximate what we want by using a theory that's not realized in nature, has the wrong gauge group, the wrong coupling value, using a method that's only conjectured to be true. So why would you do that? I would argue that because we are desperate. We really don't have anything else in our toolbox to sort of do that. Lattice QCD doesn't work. Classical QCD doesn't equilibrate. Classical QCD plus scattering doesn't equilibrate fast enough. Really, ADS-CFT is the only model we've got. I would love to have a second model to compare my results to, but it's just not out there. Okay, so that's why we use it. The footnote is, actually, there's one result from this group of thing, classical chromodynamics plus scatterings. And that's a result by François Gélis and Thomas Applebaum. And what they do is they basically try to resum quantum corrections on these plasmon stabilities that you get in these systems. And they get the system to thermalize if they push their coupling value away from, let's say, the weak coupling range to G of 1. They get values for the equilibration that are reasonable with respect to phenomenology. There are some issues with that approach. One of them is that they argue that once you sort of do that, QCD becomes non-renormalizable. So it becomes an effective theory with a scale that you have to set by hand, which they do. There are all sorts of issues with the sort of plasma simulations that they do. That's ongoing. It's ongoing studies. There are other groups that disagree with them. Particular BNL Heidelberg group doesn't agree with the results at all. But so that's out there, and that could be a promising sort of alternative, which I would like to have. But it's not fully fleshed out, I would say, at this point.
Can they understand the equation of state?
No. They are mostly concerned with non-equilibrium properties, and the method does not, I think, give you the equation of state. Okay, so if you're willing to buy that and sort of come with me to sort of trade QCD for n equals 4 supermills, then I'll sort of try to set up the problem of actually studying nucleus-nucleus collisions in that framework. And in a nutshell, what it means is that we want to sort of study objects like boosted charges with an energy stress tensor in light cone coordinates that has a component that's given by the, let's say, energy density in the in the direction transverse to my beamline. So if this is my beamline, then the X-perp is sort of a coordinate system transverse to that. And it would be because of the high Lorentz boost of these particles. Remember, we are talking about packets that have a gamma factor that are large, so 100 or more. Then this would be very much confined to a very short region. So basically, you would have a delta function in your energy stress tensor. That's the object on my field theory side. And then I want to construct a gravity dual to this. And I do that most simplistically by just sort of writing down the line elements that asymptotic ADS with an energy stress tensor, expectation value of energy stress tensor of that form. And that's the solution to this. This phi here basically is an object that has a near boundary behavior that's just z to the 4 times this rho here. And then you can calculate what the other sort of properties of that function are. This line element here then is an exact solution to Einstein equations in five-dimensional space with a cosmological constant. And it sort of provides the setup for basically just having a model for one nucleus traveling along the light cone. Any questions on that? I write down the energy stress tensor, and really the only component that's relevant is sort of this T++ component. The other ones are.
I understand that, but yeah. The state itself is not just specified by T++.
Oh, that's right. Yes, in principle, That's right. I'm choosing a particular form of all the higher order correlation functions that may or may not be relevant, that's absolutely right, and I should have said that.
So, what exactly are you choosing?
Basically, in this case, I'm choosing whatever sort of this line element sort of gives me. I can't read off the it's a shockwave. Yes. It's right. I haven't studied what the correlation functions do, but I would be interested to know how to actually validate it easily. But I don't know. Yeah, there are particular assumptions about the correlation functions. That's right. Mm-hmm.
Well, even it would be interesting to understand how can you prepare a state like that.
Well, that state I can prepare. I know how to do this. In the bulk, yes. I take a black hole and I boost it. That's how I prepare it. So that's one of the few things I know how to do. But,
okay, so this is a boosted black hole.
It's a boosted black hole, yes.
Sort of basically with the speed of light.
Yes, that's basically what it is. And it's sort of in the class of these Eichelberg-Sechsel shockwaves mm-hmm. that you might know about. So if I then want to go ahead and talk about actual collisions, I obviously need two of these guys. And the way that I prepare the initial condition is that I just superimpose line elements which have both a left-moving and a right-moving shockwave. And I'm be interested in basically looking at the collision process of these gravitational shockwaves in ADS5, and then trying to read off from the sort of post-collision line element what the metric tensor, what the energy stress tensor on the boundary theory is doing. So basically, that's the in a nutshell, the setup of what I'm trying to do. As the experts will tell you, getting the post-collision line elements, even with such a simple model as the one that I've written down, is not trivial. The post-collision line element is hard to get. Even harder would be to attempt to simulate that process numerically, simply because you have this sort of gravitational shockwave and you want to study shock-shock interaction. That's really extremely hard problem for relativists out there. Currently, in Minkowski space times, I think the limit that people can look at black hole collisions is gamma factors of about 2-ish. Is that about right? And here for the shockwaves, you would have gamma factors that are in the range of 100 to 1,000. So we are far away from that. But in principle, that would be interesting. So I'll first start out by saying that at least some insight can be gained by looking at the solutions analytically or in some analytic approximation. One of the approximations you can do is sort of this early time perturbation theory. So basically, you sit at the collision point, given in this coordinates by u is v0, and then expand around that point for times that are short, basically. And doing that, you can actually solve the post-collision line element, you can dig out the energy stress tensor, and you can say something about how the properties of the matter behave on the boundary theory. And you find interesting, you find interesting results. The energy density goes like these density of both nuclei, a product of the density of the nuclei, times the proper time squared. The fluid velocity sort of has a particular form, and that's nice. The question is, what do you do with it? Well, it turns out that you can use that to basically seed a fully numerical GR simulation for the time afterwards. So the collision process itself is very hard because you have these delta shocks. But once you sort of did the hard work, in some sense, analytically, and dug out information about what happens just shortly afterwards, you can see that for a fully numerical simulation. I sort of wanted to go there in a minute, but and basically track the remainder of the evolution that way. And that's where I'm going. I just wanted to say that this analytic sort of semi-analytic method is problematic in the sense that it's not really fully controlled in the bulk. In particular, it doesn't converge close to the horizon of the black hole, which may be not surprising. Black hole formation is not a perturbative process. But it would be nice to sort of be able to reach some sort of analytic approximations like these, sort of in the same vein that this Indian group paper did that for the lower dimensional case with the Vaida spacetime. That would be really nice to have. But right now that's not available. Okay, so using this analytic post-collision line element, we can then use that as approximate initial data for fully GR code. In this case, we use the characteristic or versions of the characteristic code from the Chesser-Yaffe scheme. And basically, I just want to go ahead and sort of show you this picture here that's coming out from this fully GR simulation. So you sort of seed your initial data from this analytic solution at the initial time slice, and then this is the temperature profile as a function of radial position, so that's the position normal to my bean line, that's coming out for the boundary theory. So initially, what you find is that the system heats up, so you sort of have a low temperature here, it sort of heats up, it reaches a maximum at some time of about 0.2 Fermi over C, and then it sort of goes over to a cooling phase that's actually very well described by fluid dynamics. And the color coding here shows the different values of the flow velocities that are locally attained. Just as a side remark, I wanted to sort of draw your attention to this white region here, where it turns out that the flow velocity can actually not be defined. This is a region of space-time where there is no local restraint. It doesn't have to do with fluid dynamics. It just means that whatever you do, there is not a frame where you can sit where the matter with respect to you is not moving. And I gave a talk about this at CETA, so I'm happy to sort of chat with you, but it's not a 5-minute story I want to get at. I just want to throw this out there in case people are interested. Okay, so you can actually do this. You can sort of do this sort of simulation using ADS as a sort of pre-equilibrium simulation scheme, take that and look at the output from that scheme, use it as initial data for hydrodynamics, run your hydrodynamics, and then if that hydrodynamics sort of falls out of equilibrium, use a Parton or Hadron cascade to follow the rest. And that's really sort of the first time that you have a fully equilibrated matching, because it doesn't really matter exactly when you switch from the pre-equilibrium ADS-CFT scheme to hydrodynamics. Because at some point, if the system is close enough to equilibrium, both of them give identical answers. Okay. So if you do that, one of the things that's interesting is that you get almost universal flow profiles for your hydrodynamic evolution at some time. So remember, this was the flow profile versus radius that I said initially is typically chosen ad hoc. People just choose something for that function. In particular, some of them choose zero. Some of them choose something else. We, at least in this ADS-CFT model, can actually calculate that. And within the model, there's a fairly well-defined answer. And the different sort of points here correspond to just slightly different initial conditions in the ADS-CFT setup. So we choose different starting time for that, different NGs. But the answer seems to be fairly universal.
So what does it mean? So this is at some given time. And so
where this is at some given time in the hydrodynamic scheme, yes.
So how do you compare to the different cases?
Different cases here are different cases for the ADS starting time. So here we started the gravity simulation at different starting times. We switched from ADS to hydro at different times, 0.4, 0.7, Fermi over C. We switched particular regulating parameters in the numerical GR scheme. None of them really sort of seems to matter very much in the sense that the flow profile that comes out is fairly universal, whatever we do.
And this one centimeter over C is measured with respect to
one.
So what sets it zero?
Zero is sort of the collision.
The moment of the collision.
The moment of the collision.
And what's your
problem? Is
beta?
This is basically beta. Yeah, it's the velocity. So it's beta. It stops at one. It doesn't go up all the way to infinity. Okay, so fine. So we can calculate that, which means that we now have at least the model prediction of what this would mean. So how about if we take that and see whether that makes any sense in comparing to data? So basically what I'm telling you is that I've removed essentially freedom from my whole model procedure, and now have a definite function that I want to put in, so I can't change it anymore. But it could be that I'm now very far away from the data, which in some sense would indicate that ADS-CFT is not such a good pre-equilibrium model. But at least I can test whether that's the case or not. The idea would be that basically, so maybe one more detail that I should have said is sort of I basically parameterized that function here. And it turns out that a very good parameterization is given by something that takes into account the so-called overlap function. That's a technical detail that I sort of maybe should have skipped. The main idea is that I want to sort of look and sort of use that function for different collision systems, basically anything that is data on. Okay? And then let's look at what you get. What is T? It's the overlap function. It's the integral of the charge density along the longitudinal direction. I can write it down for you if you're interested. So that's what you get for the temperature evolution in different experimentally realized scenarios, such as lead-lead at 2.7 TeV down to carbon-carbon, which is not yet experimentally measured. And that's the temperature in the center. And as time goes on, you sort of cool down in all of these simulations. But depending on how large the system is, so carbon is, for instance, much smaller than lead, you get different trends. So for instance, this some of the curves are much steeper. And for reference, I even show what you get for proton-proton collisions at 7 TeV, even though one doesn't expect the system to be hydrodynamic. OK, I should say that. That is the outcome that you get from the particle spectra. So these are experimentally measured data, all these dots here. And the curves here are what you get from the hydrodynamic ADS plus hydro plus cascade model. And one thing I should say is that the transport parameters for the hydrodynamic code were just 1 over 4 pi. That's consistent with the ADS solution. The equation of state was lattice QCD. Everything else is pretty standard. And what you see by looking at those spectra is that, gee, that doesn't look that bad. If I chose a completely different function, I could have messed up this comparison completely, because more radial flows, so choosing a steeper function, would mean that the spectra actually sort of tilt upwards, so they become much flatter. If I chose zero velocity, I get spectra that are much steeper. So you have less transfer flow. But overall, it doesn't look that bad across a pretty large range of collision systems and collision energies.
But it is quite different. I'm saying that all what people did, sort of ad hoc phenomenological construction, is a zero velocities. Or
yes, it's typically zero velocities. Or the other,
class,
Typically, they do not, they are versed in this, typically.
It's worse.
Yes, it's typically versed in this. Another thing that sort of is interesting, we looked at so-called HPT radii. That's just another experimental measure. I should say that historically, that was known as the so-called HPT puzzle. And the reason was that hydrodynamic models just didn't describe these radii at all. They were off by a factor of 2. OK? This is what you get if you sort of use that model. This is lead-lead data for these different radii. The blue curve is the model. Well, I mean, it's not perfect, but I mean, it's pretty. I mean, I didn't tune any parameters. This is lead-lead. This is gold-gold at 200 GeV. This is copper-copper at 200 GeV. This is gold-gold at 62 GeV. This is copper-copper at 62 GeV, and I could go on and on and on. So the main point is that this ADS plus Hydro plus cascade model certainly is not a bad choice as an initial condition. It certainly is better than choosing zero flow velocity or sort of starting fitting functions by hand or something like that. So that's the main message I want to sort of bring across. It's sort of this may be useful.
Is there any insight you can get from these previous plots that some seem to be doing much better than others?
Well, there may be some insight to that. Typically, the trend seems to be that the lower you go in energy, the better the fit actually is. Whether that points to the viscosity being higher at LHC energy, for instance, I cannot say for sure yet. But that could be one particular sort of hypothesis that you could follow. So that's the main message, is that okay, so this line of thought at least sort of doesn't look bad. It actually looks pretty promising. And what I want to do is sort of, yeah.
So as far as I remember, so one of the advantages of plasma or modified plasma initial conditions was that you can fit all these higher EMs quite
right.
Well.
Right, yes.
And you try to do the same as your...
This is for purely central collisions. So remember sort of had this picture that you have pure head-on collision.
Right.
You can't study it in that model.
So you can't do...
In this simple model, no. But maybe not too long from now. Okay, let me actually go to sort of the main subject of my talk. I said it was a very long motivation, but I'll get there eventually. So I want to sort of go ahead and do what Alex just proposed, is I want to sort of go away from these central collisions and actually study everything that's out there, in particular all these flow coefficients. For that, I have to break a lot of symmetries, and it's hard to do that in the simple model that I set up. So really, instead of trying to sort of go from this collision of shock waves that I sort of originally sent out, I want to sort of do the full problem, take black holes, collide the black holes, and look at the energy momentum tensor on the boundary for that. So that's... Okay, let me show you. So that's basically what I sort of set out to do. This is what we sort of posted on the archive pretty recently. And basically what we're using is we're sort of using Einstein field equations in generalized harmonic gauge. So for those of you who haven't seen this, so these are the Einstein equations with a particular constraint term here that has, so this is a sort of a particular gauge choice that's called generalized harmonic because sort of you have the harmonic gauge over here that would be AG0, but you sort of generalize that and sort of try to come up with good choices for this gauge condition that makes the simulation well behaved over long simulation times, basically. We also simulate in global ADS spacetime, and that's a picture of that spacetime here. So you have sort of this cylinder here, where the boundary is basically on this cylinder wall. The internal structure is the bulk of the spacetime. And if you just do that, basically the boundary of that spacetime is actually R cross S3 rather than Minkowski space. For reference, there's also the notion of the Poincaré patch, which is sort of a twisted triangle on the surface of this global ADS spacetime. And that's basically where we're actually interested in measuring things. And I show that because what we're actually simulating in this global ADS spacetime is sort of an evolution that extends much beyond the Poincaré patch. Okay. So you take these equations. In this case, because of our symmetry assumptions, there are 15 of those, and you use second-order differencing to discretize those. I won't bore you with the details. Basically, the upshot is that using some techniques borrowed from numerical GR, we can actually sort of do this. Important ingredients are numerical dissipation. We actually use excision for the black hole simulations because, well, the singularities in space-time, you can't evolve, so you have to like, size those regions. You have to use lap stamping, and you have to use a coordinate choice that is consistent with the boundary conditions of asymptotic ADS spacetime. Okay, here we go. So this is a picture of this global ADS spacetime. So again, sort of this is the wall of the cylinder. This would be the boundary. This is the bulk of the spacetime. We're just looking top down on one of the metric components. What we actually do is we sort of seed the black holes by a scalar field that then will just collapse to a black hole here and here. And then you see black surfaces that are the excised regions from our grid. So those are the ones that are inside some trapped surface, which we find. And then you sort of see the evolution of that. There's one more thing that I want to note that sort of make it be confusing. It turns out that since we use radial coordinates, the center of this coordinate patch has a coordinate singularity. Radial coordinates have a coordinate singularity at rho is zero. And we sort of struggled with that for a while, and then we found that the easiest way to deal with it was to put a regulator black hole on the origin. So actually with the three black hole simulations rather than two black hole collisions, and we can shrink that regulator black hole and make it small and sort of basically remove it and study that it actually sort of doesn't affect our actual dynamics. I can show you details about that, but that's just to so that you're not overly confused about what you see. Let me just sort of see whether it runs. There's always this question, does it run or does it not? Yeah, it does. So what you see is that as time goes on, you sort of saw these lumps coming in. They form pretty quickly a common apparent horizon, a common excised surface. And then the black hole is still moving around. It grows and shrinks, which is a coordinate artifact. So this is just really a metric component. It's not literally the surface of the apparent horizon. And then there's some stuff out here that's sort of slowly ringing down. It's eaten up by the black hole. And eventually sort of the system goes to a quiescent state. And sort of basically it's just a black hole, Eddie-Schwarzschild black hole that's just sitting there. That was for one particular separation of these black holes at a particular distance away from the center. What we eventually would like to do is push them far out so they can have more time falling in and create higher boost velocities because we want to go to these ultra-relativistic collisions. Let me show you another example that has that. So that would be a slightly larger separation. So you start out again with two of these black holes, and they sort of start moving in, and you see that it takes them a much longer time to actually sort of collide. But eventually, they also do and form this central black hole that then is ringing down and eating up all the other stuff that's around in the space-time. So
the central black hole
is a regolith. So again, so the growing and shrinking of this central of these actual circles is not respect of the actual area of the black hole. It's not the actual size of the black hole because it's a coordinate effect. I'm really just displaying one metric component rather than something that's in some sense gauging, right? No. It's pretty much just sitting there and doing nothing. It's just the coordinates that are changing because I'm using a generalized harmonic gauge. Good. So basically, it's sort of the same picture, and we sort of can push those things farther out and study higher collision velocities, which is what we do, basically.
Well, can I ask the same question? I don't think I've heard you. So why are you thinking that colliding black holes is the same as colliding nuclei? Nuclei is called matter. So it got hot only as a result of collision. So why do you want to model it as a black hole before the collision?
Right. I mean, you could model it by something different. We thought about colliding boson stars. We thought about colliding... It's just some lump of energy density. It's just the simplest thing we could think about.
Yeah, and the other thing would you got to discrete represent that other thing.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, it's not that you're particular about combining black holes. It's just that it's the simplest thing we could think about. I want to show a space diagram of the bulk for those space times. So again, we have sort of a projection of that cylinder here. Time is in that direction. Global time is in that direction. Initially, we have two black holes with apparent horizons here and there. These are black holes 1 and 2. And we have a regulator black hole that's sitting in the middle, which we can sort of make larger or smaller. As time goes on, these two things at some point merge with the regulator black hole and form one common horizon that then sort of wobbles around at very large global time, basically goes into a quiescent state. I also want to highlight that sort of the Poincaré patch is sort of indicated by this blue region here, and it terminates here. So that sort of global timeline here is the point where on the boundary, that's time infinity. Okay, so you only sort of see on the boundary up to that point, and anything else after that, you will never sort of see on the boundary. Particularly, you can engineer things in global ADS that are recurrent, so things that bounce off and come back and bounce off and come back. You'll never see this on the boundary, okay, because of that sort of wrapping of global topology to local Poincaré patch. So the way that we actually go to the boundary theory is sort of given by the usual transformation. It's sort of written down in one of these papers. Basically, you sort of project from essentially the R cross S3 to Minkowski spacetime. There's a way to do this. And then you read off the boundary stress tensor, the metric, the boundary stress tensor implying the energy density and flow velocities. So there are well-defined recipes for doing this. And then we can actually plot what, for instance, the energy density of the boundary theory is doing. In this case, this would be this full red line here. That's the linear plot of the energy density at the center as a function of Minkowski time. That's the same in a log plot. And then I show for comparison what you get if you started at some instant in time on Minkowski space, used that initial data, and just solved hydrodynamic equations instead. So GR is the full GR solution, sort of incorporates all order hydro, for instance. And the hydro curve sort of starts off here, that's the black one. Another one is here, the blue one. And then we have an orange one, I think, over there. It's more clearly exemplified in the log plot. What you'll find is that if you start too early, then the hydrodynamic solution is not a good match to the full quantum solution, the full GR solution. But if you start late enough, in this case, at times around 2 or so in mass units, then basically you essentially completely match the full GR solution. And what that seems to be suggesting is that if you wait long enough, the system becomes close to equilibrium, and hydrodynamic solutions are very similar to the full quantum solutions, full GR solutions. That's basically the upshot of the story. It's not that bad, yeah. It's not that bad, yes, that's right. Yes and no. I mean, if you're interested in detailed effects, you will see differences. But it's true that you might have expected much more difference between the full GR and the hydro solution. Yes, that's possible. But yeah, it is what it is. So that's the difference that you find.
So what you're asymptoting to is this conformal flow.
So this asymptotes to a conformal flow. Yes, that's right. Yeah. A different way to sort of show that same picture is by plotting the difference between the full one particular full entry to the metric tensor, energy stress tensor, minus the hydrodynamic solution at second order. So that's sort of the relative error, if you want so, as a function of time. So this is now in global ADS time. So what you find is that typically the differences here are on the order of 10 to 20% until a time of about 1.5-ish or something like this, where the differences get within sort of resolution error bars consistent with zero. And that's also the time when sort of the hydrodynamic solution matched on to the GR solution in the previous picture. So early on, you have 10, 20% differences from hydrodynamics. And at later times, they sort of are much closer or have solutions that are identical to the solutions of hydrodynamics.
And the gray envelope is error?
The gray is the error that you get from the independent residuals. So that's basically studying different resolutions in a GR scheme and sort of finding out what the difference is between the two of them. And then sort of that's basically what's defining the uncertainty in that region here. It's GR resolution error. This is second order hydro. You definitely expect this difference here to go to zero if you go to third order hydro and more. I don't think you would, at least naively, expect this difference to completely vanish, at least if you trunk it at low order. Yes. So you should ask Michael if you sort of can do a high order approximation to that. Using sort of the analytic techniques that they have developed. To second order, certainly, you don't see sort of this coming down a lot. First order is you see a definite difference, zero, first, and second. But first and second are not as far as part of zero as first. That's what I can say. So it's a little hard to say. I mean, this regime is sort of, I mean, yes, the middle value is very far away, but you have large resolution errors. I think we would have to study that regime more to really sort of make a conclusive sort of statement one way or the other. Yes. T equals zero is really sort of the time we start, we let the black holes loose, basically. We just initialize the whole thing and we let them loose. And then they come in and the collision actually happens only around, I would have to go back to my plot, at some later times, basically. I would have to check when actually it happens. It's the time that we, T zero is the time we let the black holes actually loose.
On the global boundary?
Yes. Yes. Initially, you mean, or yeah, yes, it's some. You do have two separate lumps. Yes.
Oh, you do.
Yes, you do. Let me. I can actually show you a picture of that. So that's basically how the boundary energy density looks like at the beginning. So that's at T zero. You have these two lumps here that sort of sit at some different location, and then the boundary here is that's Minkowski spacetime. Yeah. Yes.
That's after you mapping to a Poincaré patch.
That's right. That's on the Poincaré patch.
When you say second order part of the dynamics, that's the second order part or in
the... Now, this one is actually on the S3. That's the second order hydro on the S3, not in the Poincaré patch.
On the S3.
Yeah.
How do you know the transport coefficient?
You don't have to. You know the transport coefficient to first order and to second order. There's only. They're curvature effects, but those you can write down. Yeah, you know how to. I mean, you know all the coefficients.
But they're coupled, really. I guess I'm worried because the gradient expansion is still okay because you have curvature. Should you worry about
that? There are the curvature terms out there.
Yeah, I know that there are couplings to curvature.
Yes.
Yes.
Like that. Yes.
So you basically take that, and that's...
Yes, yes, yes. Okay, so what I wanted to show is sort of this part here, and I sort of have these initial lumps of energy density. Oh, that didn't go on very well. Let me sort of try again. So you have these initial lumps of energy density, and then you should see them come together, and then because of the conformal flow, the whole system will fall apart and expand in all directions pretty much. Somehow my video is not playing very well. Let me try again. I'm sorry. This somehow is too much for the projector or something. So you sort of see these two lumps coming in, falling into each other, and then you sort of see the whole matter going upwards, which is just a reflection of the fact that you have this conformal flow that is sort of basing it. Okay, so let me just conclude by saying that I think that, in some senses at least, the ADS-CFT dynamics is a natural model in problem equilibrium dynamics and heavy ion collisions. The results that you get by using that as a model input, in the sense of comparing to experimental data, are actually pretty suggestive. It sort of seems to be a good idea to go in that direction. And I want to argue that numerical GR is actually becoming a tool that's relevant and useful for high energy nuclear physics. Obviously, there is many things that we still want to study. Maybe key among them is sort of non-central black hole collisions in ADS spacetimes. We want to sort of generalize to non-conformal duals. And maybe sort of also think about non-relativistic applications. But all of that is sort of maybe a much longer to-do list. But I hope that I at least sort of could bring across some of the sort of excitement that we have in sort of trying to use that tool to actually sort of make contact to experimental data and do something that's relevant for at least our community. Thank you.
Questions?
If you go back to the plot of central energy.
Yes.
You were fitting very
central energy.
I mean, how much of that curve is just this, what you're calling the conformal flow?
Most of it, actually. Yeah.
So is it fair to say that the hydro is, that's where the hydro fits in, or?
If you, I don't think I brought the plot, but basically, if what happens if you can compare this, what happens if you just look at the conformal flow? So that's just an ADS Schwarzschild black hole that's just sitting there. And then the way that this would look at is basically just get decreasing flow from the GR. Basically, it's just sort of this part of the curve, just this part of the curve. It's just falling down. So the whole rise is due to the non-trivial dynamics of the two black holes basically touching each other and then sort of ringing down.
But if I'm not looking at the log plot, it looks like it's only the falling down part that's the hydro gap.
Yes, and sometimes that's not completely surprising given that the rising up here is when the two black holes actually sort of are in the process of touching and colliding with each other. That is not a hydrodynamic process is something that's not too surprising in some sense. So yes, I think I agree with you.
Does your setup allow you guys to do these off-center collisions?
No. At the moment, the symmetries we impose sort of are just for central black hole collisions, but we're sort of working on breaking that symmetry. So that's the next thing on our to-do list, is actually sort of going away from that. And Hans is currently sort of actively working on a code that can achieve that, but it's not working yet.
Can you do it on the chip? Now that you've got some control or some measure of how well the higher is doing, just doing purely on the higher side, just introduced over there, there's a perturbation that would break that symmetry, and then just given that you have a 3 plus 1 higher code.
So you're asking whether I can sort of study linear perturbations in gravity to sort of get to gravity?
No, so you use the gravity to then have confidence on your hydro.
Oh.
How early you can start it, and then just purely look at it in your hydro, because the hydro you already have the infrastructure.
Yes, you can try to do this, and that's something we're currently working on. But so you get something. I can't sort of really sort of say that sort of is. I mean, you get results that you can compare to data. The question is whether you can do any better than choosing something else, and that's something I can't answer right. But yes, you can use it as a model basically without actually doing the hard calculation. But we want to do the hard calculations. So.
Have you checked by how much if these black holes all merge, by how much the background deviates from the fluid gravity developing background?
By how much the background deviates from
the fluid gravity developing background once?
No, we have to work backwards. That's right. So that's one check that one can do, is one could use the fluid dynamics and sort of basically go back and construct the gravity background and check that difference. We have
because as far as I remember from Hans' previous paper, there, the quasi-normal modes give a very, very, very good approximation of the dynamics, but they were like disturbing, like
right.
All
yes. So it's kind of non-trivial at least for this setup, because the hydrodynamic solution here is fully numerical. So you just use initial data, use a 3 plus 1D relativistic hypersolver. To use that to then reconstruct the space-time is probably possible, but certainly not something that's completely trivial. At least I don't know.
No, you're in a special case.
In a special case, it's much easier because you have the actual. Yeah.
How much does it differ if you do the hydro just from the very beginning?
That's a good question. I probably have the data somewhere, but I don't remember how it looks like. I don't think it sort of looks much more different than this. So it sort of rises and then it falls, but sort of you have sort of the same level of disagreement that you get from this time of 0.4
like
or
black
dots. Yeah.
Doesn't seem that bad.
No, it's qualitatively it's not crazy, but yeah, so certainly it's not a close match in any sort of sense.
But if you look at the global ADS and the picture of butter, right?
Yeah.
If you have this black hole, like when you start moving it from the center, right? As you prepare your initial state.
The
right?
Black hole at the center never moves, but
no, but I mean, like, if you had a black hole in the center, you try to move it, then you have some relative equilibrium state, right? On the butter, still the picture is that the energy density is not uniform, but it fills the whole boundary, right?
You're asking about what happens if I take a single black hole and move it away from the center?
No, my point is that what I suspect is that what you have is in a global ADS, on the boundary, you have some state of matter that fills the whole sphere, right?
Yes.
And then I undergo some evolution that's discovered
yes.
by the MTR. And my question is whether you see something dramatic happening as these things start merging. If you just look on the global...
Nothing dramatic in the sense that you see some discontinuity. Basically, we could have produced a plot like this, right, like this, for the global space time, but we just didn't. Basically, it's sort of So you sort of see basically something rising and then something falling back to a constant value, but it's not dramatic in the sense that there are discontinuities.
Nothing sharp.
Nothing sharp.
Okay, so Paul is here till about noon.
Tomorrow, noonish.
And it's obvious 2:23 because we want to go back. So let's thank Paul again.
Thank you.